to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting live from Burnaby Mountain, Burnaby, BC.
This is Sovereign Canada. I'm Mike McCullough, broadcasting on CIVL, syndicated on campus and community radio stations across the country, and recorded on the shared, unceded, and traditional territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh peoples. Today on the show, we look at people power and the potency of protest as people across the country coalesce to disclose their dissent with U.S. President Donald Trump's repeated threats to Canadian sovereignty. Some folks have taken to targeting Trump's top donor and Doge Dean Elon Musk by targeting one of his companies, Tesla. First, we'll hear from Dr. David Tindall, a professor of sociology at the University of British Columbia, who argues that while protest can be effective, movements can be complicated by competing interests, and offers that Tesla takedown is no different.
So there's a whole bunch of kind of overlaying reasons why some people are upset with Musk. And then there's also several contradictions that are quite interesting, which just makes this a really complicated kind of phenomenon.
Then Sovereign Canada hits the road to check in with folks gathered at one such Tesla takedown rally.
It is having an effect. So for right now, this is all I can do, and this is what I'm going to do. And as an American, I'm embarrassed for our country. I'm just so frustrated.
Yeah, I spoke with about a dozen folks to get their take on why they're targeting Tesla in order to get to Trump. All of that ahead on Sovereign Canada, available to you at sovereigncanada.fyi. And a quick programming note that this show was recorded on and before March 27th, with the interview with Dr. Tindall occurring on Tuesday, March 25th, and the Tesla takedown rally occurring on Saturday, March 22nd in Langley. Protests have erupted around Canada to oppose Donald Trump and figures associated to him. Since Trump's daily deluge of threats against Canadian sovereignty, folks have gathered outside of U.S. consulate buildings around the country, and protesters have mobilized to target Elon Musk through protests of his Tesla brand, with gatherings outside of dealerships around Canada and the United States. We'll hear from some of those voices from one such protest billed as a Tesla takedown rally upcoming in the program. But first, let's turn to a professor at the University of British Columbia's sociology department, who has written and researched extensively about social media, social networking, and social movements, including those centered on environmental issues, including climate change and forestry. Here to discuss protests and the effect of people power, I'm pleased to welcome Dr. David Tindall.
Hello. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, it's my pleasure. Dr. Tindall, to start, I wanted to ask, what do you see as sort of the value of protest as a tool for social change?
Well, you know, as professors often say, it depends. In this particular case, I think it's complicated, but sort of for a few reasons, which I'll talk about. But to kind of try to focus on your question for a second, I think people, groups and individuals engage in protests for a variety of reasons. Sometimes what they want to do is bring attention to the cause, or, you know, get media attention, sometimes for larger goals and campaigns and so on. Sometimes they want to put pressure on particular actors, such as governments or corporations, for example, to get them to change whatever it is that they're doing. And those things are often connected in various ways. Sometimes there's also individual motivations in the sense that individuals feel a certain sense of injustice about a particular thing, and they feel that they have to act. And sometimes it's not even entirely clear that acting will make a difference, but they feel to kind of be true to themselves, they have to do something about the situation. And so I think all of those things are important to varying degrees. I think if we think about Musk and the Tesla takedown and related sorts of things, there's a whole lot of complexities, because there's a lot of people that are upset about him as an individual for a variety of reasons. Some of these have to do with Twitter and X and the way in which he's kind of changed it and really allowed, you know, a lot of racism and hate and other sorts of things to proliferate, a lot of misinformation, disinformation to proliferate in that public sphere. You know, some people are upset with him about some of the things that he's done with his companies, such as Tesla, such as, you know, really trying to stop union formation and that sort of stuff. Some people are upset with him, you know, in particular for facilitating the election of the Donald Trump administration and then becoming embedded in the administration in various ways. And, you know, here in Canada, on top of all that stuff, there's also, you know, the extent to which he's facilitating the Trump administration in, you know, intimidating Canada and threatening Canada in various ways. So there's a whole bunch of kind of overlaying reasons why some people are upset with Musk. And then there's also, you know, several contradictions that are quite interesting, which, you know, just makes this kind of a really, really complicated kind of phenomena. You know, one of the contradictions is that, you know, in some ways, Musk was a pioneer in terms of bringing electric cars onto the market and stuff like that. And you know, even though he didn't invent things, he really played a major role in making their availability widespread and you know, kind of pushing the envelope in terms of the technology and so on. So a lot of his earlier supporters, were really, you know, people on the left side of the spectrum, progressive people that were concerned about climate change and, you know, often kind of upper middle class people with high levels of education that, you know, wanted to adopt the technology as kind of a signal of the need to make changes and reduce our carbon emissions and so on. And, you know, so those people in particular feel, you know, just utterly betrayed with the sort of political direction that he has taken. So they're very upset. And, you know, another thing, I'm not sure that this is necessarily something that motivates people very much, but, you know, another interesting contradiction is that, as far as I know, Musk also has Canadian citizenship. So that's another kind of contradiction with him kind of enabling the Trump administration to intimidate Canada. So I think there's a whole lot of people with varying motivations of dislike and concern about Musk's activities.
So then that kind of brings me to when you get a bunch of different people together with maybe different motivations, can you sort of describe the networking effect of getting people who maybe in some cases like-minded, maybe have overlapping interests? What's the networking effect of when you get those individuals out on the ground in real life?
Yeah, so I think there's a few different things that go on. Like, to a certain extent, there is kind of reinforcing and amplification of, you know, kind of previously held views, which then can, you know, sometimes motivate people to get involved in things and take actions and so on. In the social movement world, there is, you know, there's also various kinds of protests events that sometimes bring people from these different points of view together to the extent to which they have kind of a common concern or a common objective or common motivation to a certain extent. And there, you know, I think that there's a couple of different things that are interesting. So, you know, in most contemporary social movements, there's groups that vary quite a bit, right? So there's groups that, you know, are say, more or less okay with the status quo, but want to tweak things. So, for example, in the realm of environmental activism, there's some groups that, you know, are okay with capitalism, but think, you know, we could tweak products and so on so that, you know, they have kind of lower carbon emissions. There's other groups that are very critical of the capitalist economic system and think that we need to make, you know, major reforms or major changes to the whole socio-political system. There's also groups that just do different things, right? So there's some groups that, you know, lobby government and do research and, you know, try to inform the public. There's other groups that are mostly involved in protests and stuff. And then there's other groups that kind of take more radical action of one sort or another. So again, you know, I'm going to talk quite a bit about the environmental movement because that's what I'm kind of most familiar with. But, you know, some different types of groups that tend to take more radical action include Greenpeace that, you know, is often involved in spectacles of various sorts. And, you know, we can think about more contemporary groups like Extinction Rebellion, contemporary in the sense that newer groups that have formed more recently that, you know, are involved in kind of various kinds of disruptions and direct actions of various sorts. But kind of looping back to, you know, kind of how I started this, I think what happens is sometimes you have, you know, protest events that some organizations, you know, hope and plan are, you know, going to maybe be disruptive, but are going to be peaceful and be legal. And then sometimes you have other actors who don't feel constrained by those rules, and, you know, might do things like engage in vandalism and stuff like that. So sometimes we see this with social movement, you know, marches and stuff where most of the protesters are, you know, just engaging in legal and peaceful protest. But sometimes there's individuals that take advantage of the situation and, you know, engage in vandalism. And, you know, a lot of the time when that sort of stuff happens, they're not even necessarily part of the protest groups or protest movement. So, you know, I think there was a fair bit of that happened, for instance, in the United States around the Black Lives Matters demonstrations and protests, where there was kind of opportunistic vandalism of shops and stuff like that, where, you know, it kind of individuals infiltrated these groups and stuff and kind of used them for their own purposes. And that happens a lot. And so, you know, kind of focusing on Tesla, you know, I'm not sure that there's widespread consensus that, you know, that Tesla cars should necessarily be set on fire. But, you know, there's some people that are willing to do that. And, you know, my thoughts on this are that probably, you know, most kind of organized groups are relatively hesitant to overtly suggest that as a tactic, because there's going to be retaliation against them from governments and from police forces and so on. And so, you know, people will be arrested, you know, organizations may be shut down. And in the U.S., they're threatening to declare these kinds of protesters as domestic terrorists, which kind of can bring a whole new level of policing and repression and so on. And so that kind of gets pretty messy. But the other thing that I do want to connect this to is that, you know, I think that these types of protests either have or have the potential to be part of larger things that might be going on, right? And so it sort of seems slow at the moment, but I think that, you know, the momentum is building to mass protests in the United States against the Trump administration. And I think there's already some plans for some big protests in the first weekend of April in the United States. You kind of mentioned, you know, some similar things, maybe on a smaller scale in Canada in terms of protests against the U.S. and stuff like that. And so to a certain extent, I think these protests against Tesla in Canada could be connected to protests against the United States. But I think a really important thing is, you know, what is the reaction and how does this play out, right? And so on the one hand, I think, you know, some of these protests could, on the one hand, serve to inspire other people to get involved in protests and maybe be a bit more engaged than they are. Or it could work the other way. And, you know, certainly in terms of climate politics, I think that there's some things that kind of more radical groups have done that have kind of turned off the public in some ways, right? And so, you know, one kind of relatively high profile thing was this whole business of, you know, throwing soup at sort of old paintings and stuff like that in museums. And, you know, I think there's some evidence that that kind of did more to sort of turn people off than inspire them to join the fight to deal with climate change. I think similarly in some places, including in Canada and in the UK, some of the protests of Extinction Rebellion and stuff, such as blockading roads and bridges and stuff like that, I think that kind of did more to sort of turn off support amongst the general public than it did to help. So, you know, there's always this question of whether the audience that, you know, some of these people are trying to maybe inspire, whether it inspires them or whether it turns them off. But then on the other side, you know, especially in the United States, these types of events could be used as an excuse for just a major, major, major crackdown. And, you know, I think, you know, it's not very, it doesn't take very much imagination to think about the notion that, in the United States, if there's mass protests, and especially if there's mass, you know, vandalism and damage to property, this might lead the Trump administration to, you know, do something pretty dramatic, you know, such as to declare a state of emergency or bring in the National Guard or, you know, maybe even bring in the military. And, you know, this might sound kind of out there, but, you know, this was talked about in the first Trump administration. And, you know, the level has been turned up about 10 notches.
Yeah, and we saw some of that for an example of a delegitimizing effect. Another example from recent history, Toronto, the G20 protests, there was the Black Bloc group who started doing vandalizing and setting fires. And this had an immediate delegitimizing effect, and it led to a crackdown where the police were kettling everybody in streets together and just doing mass arrests and detentions. Can you sort of point to how you touched on it a little bit in your last answer, but I wanted to really drill into that sort of the delegitimization of what is at first often starts as a peaceful protest. Are these often malign actors who have an intention of disrupting the protest, or is it just people who don't understand peaceful protest and they take things too far, or maybe a mixture of both?
I think it varies. My sense for some of the protests over things like the World Trade Organization and stuff like that, that there's a lot of actors that, you know, basically were anarchists. And so they, you know, they actually think that aspects of the capitalist system are illegitimate. And so they think that that type of protest is actually pretty legitimate. But, you know, there's other, certainly I've been sort of hanging around quite a bit with a lot of environmental movement stuff. And there, at least in Vancouver, where I'm based, you know, there's a lot of concern about protocol amongst leaders and stuff like that. And that, you know, that people follow the sort of rules that leaders set down. And, you know, there's often a certain amount of sort of policing, quote unquote, you know, within the movement that, you know, that you shouldn't do this sort of thing. Or if you do this sort of thing, you know, it needs to be coordinated with other people, and it needs to be peaceful, and that sort of thing. So either of these things can happen. And then there's also, you know, the situation where sometimes there's plants from the other side that are there to actually, you know, stir the pot and stuff like that.
So then what can you do as an organizer? Say you want to get behind topic A, B, or C. You know, how can you keep your collective organized behind a unified voice without these splinters of violence or disruption casting doubt or delegitimizing your movement?
Yeah, so you know, I guess there's kind of a difference between the movement at a larger scale and particular events, right? And so often particular events are organized in a certain way. So for instance, that groups that are involved in the events will have kind of, you know, sort of parade marshals that will, you know, kind of be spread out over the route of a march and stuff, and they sort of keep an eye on things and, you know, and often try to keep people in line. You know, there's often kind of a certain amount of training, and especially, at least, you know, again, my experience in British Columbia here is where there's plans to do things like civil disobedience, that, you know, people often are involved in workshops beforehand where, you know, there's kind of a consensus about, you know, what's appropriate and what's not appropriate and how to do those sorts of things. So I think events can be planned and managed to a certain extent. I think that, you know, when you have sort of mass protests that are kind of relatively spontaneous and less rooted in organizations, then it's kind of harder to control some of these things.
Yeah. So what do you think about these recent Tesla takedown protests in an effort to pressure Trump via Musk? Do you think it's working?
I don't think that Musk or Trump are very susceptible to that kind of protest. I think that if anything, somebody like Trump is probably somewhat gleeful about this because it gives him the option of ramping up, you know, repression and policing and so on. So it's kind of a card in his hand that he can take certain types of actions that would normally be seen as being fairly authoritarian.
So then what can you do if protests can be used as, even if it is just peaceful, if that can be used to delegitimize dissent, what is a better way of going about it then, do you think?
I think in normal times, a lot of people would say, be disciplined, right? So, you know, make sure that the protest is peaceful, you know, try to communicate clearly with the audience, you know, try to maintain a certain amount of discipline over actors that are involved in events and so on, so that they're not crossing the line, you know, try to do things that connect with everyday people so they kind of understand what you're doing. And, you know, kind of related to that, you know, make sure that you have sort of people who are kind of sympathetic figures that are kind of out on the front lines in some sense. So again, you know, some of the protests in BC, you know, to kind of use a slightly different example, some of the Indigenous protests in BC, what communities often do is they send out elders, you know, elders in terms of their position, but also in terms of their age, and they go out and are on the front line, right? And, you know, they don't look very menacing, right? And so they're better able to sort of deliver a certain type of message, which is a little bit different from, say, you know, a 28-year-old guy wearing a bandana and carrying a weapon, right? Which is, you know, a totally different type of message, right? So I do think that there's things that organizers can do. But I also think that in the United States, this is an unprecedented period of time. In, you know, it's kind of hard to know how far the Trump administration is gonna take things. In normal times, it would be it would make logical sense for the opposition to have mass peaceful protests to pressure the government to change their course. In this situation, that might just, you know, turn up the heat and you know, lead to retaliation of the National Guard or the military or something like that. I mean, in Canada, like, I don't think we're in the same sort of situation in terms of there being a risk of the military being set on protesters. Although I will say, you know, at a small scale, governments in the past have kind of talked about similar things with regard to environmental protesters. So, for instance, one of the lead protesters in the Clockwit Sound protests was charged with, you know, some pretty serious crimes, kind of a amounting to kind of treason types of things. You know, both the former premier of British Columbia and the premier of Alberta and people in Stephen Harper's government sort of talked about environmentalists as kind of enemies of the state, right? And so certainly there's been some of that kind of language in the past, but kind of generally speaking, you know, I don't see that kind of application of the military or the police to protests in Canada. But what is different at the moment is that we're kind of in a, you know, a seeming existential crisis where, you know, we have the leader of the United States basically kind of threatening to take us over, which is, you know, not a normal situation. And, you know, certainly that seems to have motivated a lot of spontaneous patriotism in Canada, right? And so, you know, some of the political parties are trying to take advantage of it, but I don't think that it was orchestrated by partisan politics. I think it was pretty spontaneous. You know, and so that, you know, again, kind of lends a kind of unique flavor to what's going on. So I could see, you know, I could very easily see mass peaceful protests in Canada around, you know, some of these issues.
Yeah, a man I spoke with last show or a show ago, Nasser Nabahat from the Ivanhoe Pub, one of the things he stressed to me is that he wants to see a mass protest across Canada.
He should push for a huge gathering of people on the street saying that we are against. Because if you don't do that, our South neighbor, they think that we are really agreeing what they are saying. And we need, as a people, to go out on the street and just say, no, we don't want.
How would a collective go about setting the groundwork for that to stage something that's, you know, national?
Yeah, so I think that, you know, I think in principle that's possible. The question is, what is the organizational rationale, right? So we've certainly had, you know, certain types of mass protests in Canada over certain issues. So, you know, several years ago before COVID, we had mass climate change protests kind of connected loosely to, you know, Fridays for Future. And Greta Thunberg came to Canada and I think went to Montreal and went to Vancouver and went to a few other places. And, you know, there was protests in both of those, both in Montreal and Vancouver, but other cities as well, where there was over 100,000 people who came out to protest, right? And so, you know, so that indicates to me that, you know, that kind of scale of protest or demonstration is quite possible. There's been, you know, there has been situations where there's been other mass protests, especially coalitions of various sorts, often around kind of political, economic sorts of things, you know, sometimes about the implementation of laws and so on. So I think it's hypothetically possible. It's just kind of, what is the organizational leadership for something like this? So I've been talking about the environmental movement. I don't think it's, you know, kind of an environment specific type of thing. I think it's tricky for political parties to kind of be the leads on this, you know. So for instance, whoever forms the government, they can't really be organizing these types of things, because at the same time they have to engage in diplomatic relations with the United States. So there it's kind of like, you know, what is the leadership? What are the organizations? And I think ultimately it has to be some kind of coalition where you have different groups coming together, you know, labor and, you know, maybe some different social movement groups of various sorts and so on.
And truly from the ground up in that case, right?
Yeah.
So then to me, like a lot of the social media of it all, which often acts as more of like a release valve for people to just say something and get it off of their chest, can kind of in a way have a double-edged sword kind of thing, right? Like where people are getting things off of their chest, but maybe they don't act on it. But then at the same time, maybe they end up becoming more engaged. So can you kind of get into how important it is to move from social media to real life on the streets?
Yeah, I mean that's a great question, and you know you're probably kind of sort of hinting at this, but there's this term called slacktivism, which kind of refers to the idea that you know that some people see things on social media and like them and forward them, and then that's all they ever do, and they sort of think you know job done, and they can tick that off their list, but it doesn't necessarily amount to very much. I think the social media landscape.